Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is an investigative reporter whose work has changed behaviors and our understanding of the issues he covers, which he does so in great depth over multiple years in books as well as films. Eric Schlosser is the author of Fast Food Nation, his first book, the 2001 book that helped change the way Americans think about industrialized food production. He also produced the film Fast Food Nation and the documentaries Food Incorporated and Food Chains. His most recent book, Command and Control, investigated the safety of our nuclear arsenal and documented the nation's efforts to prevent nuclear weapons and its components' materials from being stolen, sabotaged, or accidentally detonated. This project has also resulted in several films, the PBS documentary Command and Control about the 1980 Damascus, Arkansas explosion and fire at a Titan II site, as well as the multimedia project The Bomb. The film version of The Bomb will be shown in conjunction with Schlosser's appearance as the next University of Tulsa presidential lecturer. He'll be appearing Thursday evening, March 15th at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. The lecture is free to the public. On Monday evening, the 12th, TU will present a showing of The Bomb, which takes place at the Lorton Performance Center at 7 o'clock. That's also a free event as well. Eric Schlosser is my guest today. Eric Schlosser, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when you choose an investigative subject, unlike a lot of investigative journalists, it's not about coming up with an article or even maybe a quick book. You go into a multi-year deep dive into the subject, it seems, so far. What informs your choices about what you want to spend so much time with learning about?
Well, the first thing is, does it seem important? And is it something that I want to commit a lot of time to looking at? Sometimes I'll find an issue and it seems really important, and then I find that someone else has already written a good book on it, and I'm delighted because then I get to read that book, learn what I need to know, and I don't have to do it. But what I've tended to get involved in are issues that seem really important that the mainstream media isn't covering, or that the mainstream media isn't covering in a way that I think captures the essence of the subject. So I don't plan. I don't set out to spend years and years on one of these things. But I do dive deep, and I'm old school in the sense that, or maybe I'm just out of my mind, I don't have any researchers, I don't have an assistant. So I do all the research and all the reading and all the reporting myself, and that takes time.
Your most recent subject has been the U.S. nuclear arsenal, the subject of the book Command and Control. I have to ask you, because there's been a lot of news lately about the nuclear arsenal, the United States nuclear arsenal, and the world's nuclear arsenals. Most recently, Russian President Vladimir Putin, his statement to the Russian people on March 1st that Russia is now developing nuclear weapons designed to overcome U.S. Missile defense systems. In fact, he's tested a nuclear propulsion engine that could power nuclear cruise missiles or drones to go anywhere in the world. What was your reaction to that announcement?
Well, you know, a lot of the attention is focused on these exotic new weapons that have been announced. One, this nuclear-powered cruise missile with a nuclear warhead, and another is an undersea drone that carries a massively powerful nuclear warhead that would go underwater deeply, therefore evade all of our anti-missile defenses and destroy American port cities. So those have received a lot of attention, and they should, because they're really science fiction bizarre weapons. But what concerns me much more are the weapons that Russia already has and the weapons the United States already has and India and Pakistan. And I got deeply involved in the whole realm of nuclear weapons in 2007 when I started the book, because I was concerned this was a grave threat and that very little attention was being paid to it. Most of the time, I really loved being right. And on this issue, I'm very sorry that more than a decade ago, I was worried that this posed such a threat, and now we see the threat is growing. I mean, I'm not apocalyptic. I don't think we're all doomed. I don't lie in bed at night worrying about the bombs about to drop. But unfortunately, there are experts in this field who are apocalyptic, and I think it's something that we need to be concerned about. We need a real public debate about, and we need to take very seriously, much more seriously than much of the rhetoric from Washington and Moscow.
And of course, it's not just a Washington and Moscow debate anymore. It's a Pyongyang debate. It's many other places. As even President Trump said, he said, all countries are going to have them, or we're going to totally get rid of them, which that also seems very unlikely on the face of it. So perhaps the former statement is perhaps a little more truth there.
Well, they both are extreme alternatives. And what's remarkable is that the first nuclear weapon was used to destroy a city 72 and a half years ago. And right now, there are only 9 countries that have nuclear weapons out of almost 200 countries. So the record on non-proliferation is encouraging, and I don't see any reason to believe that every country will have nuclear weapons. That would be catastrophic. I happen to support the abolition of nuclear weapons. I think it's as a goal. It's something that we have to aim for. I don't think it's going to occur next week. I don't think it's going to occur next year. But if we keep that as the aim, then we can move in that direction. And a lot of the news right now is incredibly depressing on nuclear weapons. But the reality is that since the height of the Cold War, the world's nuclear arsenals have declined by, I think, 80%. So real progress has been made. What's concerning to me right now is that that progress has not only stalled, it looks like it's being reversed, and we're on the cusp of a new nuclear arms race. And that is a really bad, bad idea.
The United States already mentioned that they're planning on modernizing their arsenal. You've taken a long, steady look at the state of our current arsenal. What concerns you most about the current state of our arsenal?
Two things. One, how old so much of the technology is, and particularly the command and control systems. Those are the communication systems, the wiring that help you launch or prevent you from launching your weapons. That's the first thing that concerns me. And its vulnerability, for example, to cyber attack, that someone could get into our system, disrupt it, or even launch something by hacking in. The other thing that concerns me is that we have about 400 land-based missiles that are ready to go, that are on alert, and within a few minutes of getting the signal from Washington, would be launched. And once they're launched, they can't be called back. Now, keeping our missiles on alert was a Cold War policy when we were very worried about a Soviet surprise attack. We wanted to be able to get our missiles out of the ground before they were destroyed by incoming Soviet warheads. But in the year 2018, I think the risk of an all-out Russian attack on the United States out of the blue, that risk is much lower than the risk of a mistake, of an accidental launch, or a launch being ordered when we think we're under attack, but, you know, we're not really under attack. So those are the two things, the aging nature of the equipment and the fact that the land-based missiles are on such a short fuse.
How old is the command and control system? Because when you were talking about cyber attack, I was thinking, you know, there's a good chance a lot of those operating systems are, in fact, so old that nobody knows how to go about hacking them.
Well, that's the optimistic view. You know, when you go into the Minuteman III launch complexes now, the computers, some of the computers that would receive the launch order use 8-inch floppy disks.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, there were some arguments made that the software is so old that it would be very difficult to hack into. But at the same time, that software is very simple. And certainly if you had an insider, as you did with Edward Snowden, I mean, if Snowden was a private contractor who got access to some of the top secrets of the United States, and the NSA is responsible for our launch codes and for the cryptographic equipment that decodes those codes. So if you have an insider and you have really simplistic computer code, you could have all kinds of problems. Now, they have been updating the command and control system since the 1980s, but you know, some of the major pieces of that system are 30 years old. And in the year 2018, there's all kinds of about someone getting into the system and disabling it, someone getting into the system and trying to launch a missile, or someone getting into the system and trying to spoof it. That would be, for example, telling our early warning radars that we're under attack when we're not. And if we think we're under attack, there's enormous pressure to launch one of those missiles. So these things sound like the realm of bad Hollywood thrillers, but this is the reality of our nuclear weapons complex in the year 2018. So if you're going to have nuclear weapons, there's no question something's got to be modernized. I mean, I fully, fully support modernizing the command and control systems immediately and spending every dollar that's necessary. But when it comes to brand new missiles, brand new bombers, brand new submarines, we need a real debate in this country about whether we want to recreate the whole Cold War arsenal for the 21st century. And there are many, you know, I think there's not a lot of logic in doing that.
In some of your more recent writings about nuclear weapon issues, you spent quite a bit of time talking about the threat of insiders to nuclear security, the security yeah. of uranium supplies that are used for nuclear weapons or plutonium supplies or yeah. the facilities themselves. And how serious does the government take that threat of an insider?
You know, the government takes very seriously the threat to the fissile material, the enriched uranium and plutonium that a terrorist could use to make a bomb. It's a real concern. At the same time, the fact that it's a real concern doesn't necessarily mean that urgent action is being taken. And that has to do with government bureaucracies and just how complicated it is to get anything done. So I wrote about a break-in at the Y-12 National Security Complex in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is our biggest storehouse for highly enriched uranium. And, you know, three people, including an 82-year-old nun, were able to get through the high security systems and get to the building where this stuff was stored. Now, they were pacifists and anti-nuclear protesters, but if they had been well-trained commandos, they could probably have gotten into that building and caused enormous damage and maybe even set off a nuclear detonation that would have been very messy in the heart of Tennessee.
In that article, you document a number of cases by these pacifist groups, the Plowshare movement, in which yeah. they're able to get through security pretty easily. And basically, they worked on the blast shield of a ICBM site until the juice went out on their jackhammer, and then they just sat there and recited prayers until finally somebody came to pick them up.
It's a problem. It's a real problem, because our nuclear weapons complex was built during the Cold War when we were worried about the Soviets. We were not worried about international terrorists within the United States trying to get stuff to make a bomb or trying to create a big mess. So I found these Plowshare activists who are Catholic, Christian activists who believe that nuclear weapons are evil and really an offense to all of creation. And what they've been doing for years is breaking into nuclear weapons sites and then spray-painting them with pacifist slogans and banners as direct action protest against nuclear weapons. Now, that's a fascinating form of protest, but it's also very useful, almost as a red team, to see what the vulnerabilities of our nuclear security is. And again, they've been able to break into these places. If you were to create from scratch, for example, land-based missiles in the United States, you probably would not scatter them all over the upper Great Plains as we have them completely unguarded. When I was driving around the missile fields throughout, you know, Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana, you can just drive up to one of these missile silo complexes. It's surrounded by a chain link fence. There are no guards. There's nobody there. And because of the enormous distances from some of the bases, it would take quite a while for a security team to get there. Now, I'm not encouraging any of your listeners to try to do this, but it's a concern. It's a real concern. And in the article, I wrote about how, you know, some of our major facilities, like the Y-12 complex, are being guarded by private contractors. And again, you know, you see abuses and corruption in some of these private military contractors, and they aren't. You know, I'm an opponent of private prisons. But these private guards aren't guarding, you know, armed robbers. They're guarding uranium that's been enriched and plutonium that can create bombs that will destroy entire cities. And their track record is not very good at, you know, dealing with some of these intrusions. Again, I'm not apocalyptic. I don't want any of your listeners to, you know, go into a clinical depression and think we're all doomed. But these are really, really important issues. And my aim has been to try to provoke discussion and debate over them so that they're not just, you know, basic decisions aren't being made by bureaucrats in secret in Washington, D.C.
My guest today is Eric Schlosser, investigative journalist and best-selling author. His most recent book was Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. He's also the author of Reefer Madness, Fast Food Nation, And he'll be the next University of Tulsa presidential lecturer, Thursday, March 15th at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center, and the author of a forthcoming book, The Great Imprisonment. Before we get off this subject, the break-in at Y-12, it's been called the Fort Knox of where we keep our enriched uranium. And yet you contrast going to Fort Knox, which has massive walls, active duty fort right next door, U.S. uniformed personnel guarding the gold repository at Fort Knox. And you said a pound of gold is worth, you know, one price. You could add several zeros to a pound of enriched uranium, and yet you have private security firms. It was nothing like Fort Knox for
these pacifists to break into. I'm in New York City right now. There's even more gold, I think, under the Federal Reserve Building here in New York. And it's not guarded by private contractors. It's guarded by the U.S. Mint Police. And they haven't lost any gold yet. If I had a choice, a few tons of gold being stolen from, you know, our depository, or a few hundred pounds of plutonium, I'd rather we lose the gold, because you only need 30 or 40 pounds, or even less, 10 pounds of plutonium to destroy a city. And yet we have these private contractors being hired to guard these really important facilities.
To sort of segue to what you've been working on more recently, I was struck by you actually managed to talk to one of these pacifists who are now in federal prison in person.
Yeah.
Most you weren't able to talk to in person, which I find that's kind of hard for me to believe.
Yeah.
But
well, the government believed that Sister Megan Rice, an 82-year-old, lovely, sweet, kindly nun, was so dangerous that they wouldn't let me visit her in prison. But I was able to visit Leavenworth Penitentiary, which is a pretty heavy-duty prison, in order to visit another Plowshares activist. And it was just, I mentioned in the piece, what was extraordinary to me is that security around this pacifist seemed so much more intimidating than security around, you know, the fissile material, the enriched uranium, that could cause a bomb. And certainly the walls were a lot higher around Leavenworth than they are around the Y-12 complex. These are real concerns. You know, I think that climate change is a threat of existential importance, and I'm a huge believer, yes, climate change is occurring, and also we have to do something about it to slow the pace and maybe reverse it. But to me, the nuclear threat is greater, it's more immediate, and it's more irreversible. And I say this, if any city anywhere in the world is destroyed by a nuclear weapon, you will get a massive worldwide anti-nuclear movement. And I just hope we get that movement without having to lose a city somewhere.
Now, prior to your appearance, the university is going to have a showing of, I think it's the film version of your multimedia project, The Bomb,
yeah,
which you did with a live electronica band and huge speakers. Tell us a little bit about that project.
You know, my book, Command and Control, came out in 2013. And when I'm writing a book, I'm just writing a book. And as I said, I don't have any help. I do it all myself. And then when it's done, I think of ways, and people approach me of ways, to take that same subject matter and look at it in other media. So there was a documentary based on Command and Control, directed by a friend of mine, Robbie Kenner, who also did a film called Food, Inc. that was inspired by Fast Food Nation. And that was the documentary based on Command and Control. It was in theatrical release, and it was on PBS, and I'm very proud of it. It was a more conventional documentary. And I was just thinking about how to get people to address this issue. And another friend of mine I'd worked on with another film, and we came up with the idea of doing this multimedia piece on nuclear weapons. Now, that might sound like the worst thing that you'd ever want to see, and who would want to see it? But because it was a collaborative effort, I can say quite honestly, it turned out to be pretty cool. And we opened it at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2016, and we rented out a building, and we surrounded the audience with 8 enormous screens in a circle around the audience. So the audience was in the middle of the film, and there was a band that played the soundtrack live also in the middle of that circle. And it was a big success. So we did it at the Berlin Film Festival. It was just done at the Sydney Festival. And ideally, you would have 8 big screens surrounding you and a live band playing the music. It's a very visceral experience. It's a non-linear film. But, we were quite gratified that people liked the film enough so that it's on Netflix, it's on iTunes, and so it's now being shown sometimes in theaters on a single screen without the live band, and it's not all doom and gloom. One of the things about nuclear weapons is they're kind of beautiful objects. They're quite shiny. They're beautiful, shiny machines, and when they blow up, if you're nowhere near them, the explosions are quite beautiful. They really are. There's a kind of a dark appeal for these things, which is one of the reasons why countries build them. And the film is quite, you know, we really look at the appealing parts of it, but then ultimately,
it's like watching
a bad idea.
It's like watching a bonfire in many ways.
Well, I love fireworks.
Yeah, no, I mean, a bonfire.
My brother-in-law and I have been known to put on motorcycle helmets and light them off, and you know, with these Chinese-made fireworks, sometimes they miss fire. I love fireworks, and if you like fireworks, these nuclear detonations are pretty spectacular. Again, as long as they're on film and you're nowhere near them. So the bomb, which is playing in Tulsa, it's an hour long. It doesn't have a narrator. It's not a conventional documentary, but it's very carefully structured. It's not just a random series of images. One of the films that was really inspiring to me was Koyaanisqatsi, which came out in the 1980s and had an original score by Philip Glass. And that film was about, you know, the modern world and the destruction of the environment, but it was very powerful and memorable. And we tried to do something that would be entertaining and appalling and gripping and memorable. And so I hope people can go see it.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to ask about something that you've been working on for the last few years. It's actually something you've been working on for a long time. I think it was 1998 when you first wrote a major article on the United States' imprisoned population. And I know you're currently working on a book titled The Great Imprisonment. It's 20 years since that article. I think at the time, the number imprisoned in the United States was around 1.8 million. I think that number today is over 2.3 million. What's changed over 20 years since you first wrote that article, other than the number of people imprisoned?
Well, you know, I've wanted to write this book since before I wrote Fast Food Nation. And I've started it, put it aside, and now I'm really planning to finish it. Sadly, with all the fundamentals of this issue, what I wrote in 1998 is remarkably accurate about what's happening today. And again, it's not because I'm this great genius or something, it's because so little has changed in 20 years. You know, I think at the maximum, we had 2.5 million people behind bars. Now it's 2.5. Most of the reduction in inmates has been two states, California and Texas. And the day-in, day-out experience of people behind bars is just profoundly, sadly, unchanging in the last 20 years. There is one thing that's changed, and it's significant, which is there's more discussion. There's more of a spotlight put on this issue. There are more states that are debating making changes to their criminal justice system, that are making those changes. So whereas when I wrote the prison industrial complex, which was this article in 1998, it really wasn't being discussed as an issue. Now it is a national source of debate. And the book that I'm trying to finish, I hope, will go beyond the current debate on prison and look at the prison as an institution, and look at the role it's played in American history, particularly in the last 30 years, so that when we think about, well, what do we do with people who break the law, or people who are drug addicted, or people who are seriously mentally ill, we have some kind of context for making these decisions. So the book will take you all over the United States, and it'll take you back in time in history, and it'll look at periods in which we've had great compassion for the weak and the poor, and periods in which there's been no compassion and where punishment has been seen as the best thing to do to these people.
Let me ask you, when you were writing about that in 1998, about the prison industrial complex, it was just really ramping up that you were starting to see private prisons being embraced by a lot of states. You saw how communities in economically depressed areas where whatever had been the lifeblood of the economy, local economy, had dried up, they were turning to prisons as a way to bolster their local economy. In the 20 years since, I would think that prison industrial complex has done nothing but mature. How entrenched is it today in your mind?
It's hugely, hugely entrenched. And earlier I said that a new nuclear arms race, honestly, that's the worst idea that anyone could have. And I would say a private prison industry isn't quite at that level. A nuclear arms race could destroy all living things on Earth. But the private prison industry is a corrupting influence in American life. And again, you see the way that money is determining criminal justice policy. And the commodities at stake are human beings. And just philosophically, I oppose locking up people for profit. And then when you see how this industry actually operates, it's also impractical, expensive, inefficient, and corrupting. That industry, the private prison industry, was on the verge of bankruptcy and collapse. It was rescued by President Bill Clinton, who decided at the end of his second term to start sending immigration detainees to private prisons. It was part of his desire to shrink government, or at least having left office, you know, having made an effort to shrink government. So the industry was bailed out by the federal government. It is now earning incredible profits, locking up immigrants in conditions that are Dickensian. And I could go on at length about it. Having said that, it's not as though our state prisons are all wonderful places either. But we really have to, I think, get to the fundamentals. Why do we have prisons? What are they good for? What are they not good for? And those kind of elemental discussions need to take more and more space in our public debate on this issue. Hopefully, my book can be part of that discussion.
We'll look forward to that. Is it 2019 at this point?
You know, I'm loath to say, because I'll feel so much better when I've written the last word of the last page. But I'm getting closer. And I mean, I've been working on this for so long. It's just...
Has it been nearly 20 years?
I have not been working on it continuously for 20 right. years, but I went into my first prison almost 25 years ago, and I've wanted to write a book on it ever since. And I can't guarantee that the book that I'm going to write and finish is going to be good, but I know in my heart that the subject could not be more important, and that so much of what I've learned is important. So I'm hoping, even if the writing doesn't work, that the subject matter and the issue and some of these people I've met and the, I mean, again, you're in Oklahoma. I mean,
yeah, we know.
Just extraordinary what's happened in your state, what's happening there right now. And one of the big themes of the book is you may not be in prison. You may never know anyone who goes to prison. You may never visit one of these places. But what's happening in these buildings affects all of us, and we're connected to it.
Eric Schlosser, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Investigative journalist and best-selling author Eric Schlosser speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. He'll be the next presidential lecturer at the University of Tulsa Thursday evening, March 15th at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. And his multimedia project, the film version, The Bomb, will be shown Monday evening, March 12th at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. Both events are free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.